Morning, Judge.
Robert Gettleman of the Northern District of Illinois. Reverend Judge Gettleman, we're honored to
be here. It's my honor to be here.
First case this morning is number 07-1562, Value Vinyls against the United States. Ms. Powell.
The interpretation of ordinary tax schedule subheading 3921.90.11. And we believe that the trial court's interpretation of that provision is erroneous. The trial court's interpretation was predicated solely on former item 355.81 of the tax schedule of the United States. We contend that that statute is irrelevant. The terms of that provision, item 355.81, along with the language of Head Note 2C, which governs that item, clearly indicates that that provision is a value-based provision. Application under that provision is dependent on the value of the man-made materials contained in that provision. Whereas in subheading 3921.90.11, by the language of that provision, classification is based on weight. In that provision, in the HTS, there's no head note 2C, there's no equivalent provision in the HTS. So the difference in the different criteria for the two statutes, that fact alone indicates that item 355.81 was not intended to, those two items were intended to cover the full merchandise.
Don't they cover the same merchandise?
No, they don't. I think that they can, but by their terms, they don't cover identical merchandise. If you look at item 355.81, in order to be classified under that provision, the man-made material has to be in achieved value. If you look at the HDS provision, you have to look at the weight. So in the HDS provision, it's the weight. So also compare it to, if you look at the rest of the language, the non-man-made items.
But wouldn't this tarp material have been covered under the old TSUS classification?
Yes, it would.
And wasn't it the intention to maintain the same classification under the HTSUS?
The intention was, if the president had stated, to the extent possible to maintain the same duty rate, but it still has to be consistent with traditional tools of statutory interpretation. If you interpret 3581 and 3921.90.11 as covering the same merchandise, you read out all of the language in 3921.90.11. The difference in language indicates a different meaning and a difference in scope.
Is there any legislative history to back you up on that?
In terms of, well...
Of that intention to change this from weight to...
There isn't any, or to weight from quality? There isn't any explicit legislative history where it says expressly that's with it, but it's well established that if there is a change in language, it's presumed that there's a change in meaning. And if you look at the two provisions, they're clearly and materially different. One's value-based and one's weight-based. And if Congress wanted the provisions to be the same, it could have just carried that language from 35.81 over to 3921.90.11. But it didn't. And you know, that indicates that there should be some change in the scope of that provision.
But is that really how it was structured when they decided to harmonize the tariff schedules? The idea of preserving the continuity, I think, was taken for granted in many areas, even though different words were used.
I think in certain instances, there probably was a presumption that there'd be continuity, but my research and the trial court didn't point out any express intent that the two provisions, the TUSIS provisions and the HDS, cover the same merchandise. It sort of assumes that it should, just by the fact that they were changing the 3581 was being amended at the same time the Harmonize was coming into existence.
So where did the Court of International Trade get it wrong?
We contend that the Court of International Trade got it wrong from the beginning. It was supposed to start with the language of the statute. Look at the language of the statute and interpret. That's supposed to be, the language of the statute is supposed to evidence Congress's intent. The Court really didn't do that. The Court sort of went backwards. It looked at the conversion schedule and seemed to work back from that and try to piece it together. And I think one of the good example cases is the Semprit case. It's not binding, but I think it teaches in a way that the Court in that case went through the analysis. It looked at the language. It said, let's look at the common meaning of this language, and that's what it did. And
but the government actually lost in Semprit. I mean, you all argued the exact opposite position in Semprit of what you're arguing here. See, one of the things I found a little troubling was in the brief there are many instances where you talk about the plain language of this statute being clear as requiring two or more. I don't see how it could be so clear when the government itself, in a very similar statute with similar language, argued that the meaning of that statute was the exact opposite of this. I understand now you have to follow the law, and you think Semprit caused you to change your position on this just in order to follow that law, but it doesn't seem so clear. Because you yourself, the government that is, argued the exact opposite meaning for very similar words in Semprit, didn't you?
We did. But the decision in Semprit expressly stated that our interpretation was incorrect. It was inconsistent with the actual definition.
But how can you say it's so clear now? You criticized the CIT for looking at the conversion table, and you're saying they should have started with the plain meaning of the words. The government itself held the position for many years that the plain meaning of very similar words was the opposite of what it's arguing today the plain meaning is. I realize you're following the law. The CIT told you that words that are very similar mean the opposite of what you seem to think they are. That being said, it's a little difficult to stand up and say the plain meaning of these words is convincingly this when you all harbored the belief for a very long time that they meant the opposite of what you're saying they are today. And it kind of justifies why the CIT needed to look to the conversion table and other things, because clearly the plain meaning of this word is not quite as plain as maybe we wish it were.
I understand the Court's point, but I think the trial court, even if it did believe that the statute was ambiguous, going to the history of 355.81 and reviewing it was wrong. There's no evidence in the opinion or the history that we looked at that states that provision is supposed to govern 3921.90.11. There's nothing in that.
He didn't say it governed. Didn't he say it was a relevant consideration? Like legislative history doesn't govern, but it's certainly most of the time considered to be relevant to the interpretation of a statute. In fact, I believe we have case law that says the conversion table is relevant. It certainly is not dispositive, but I didn't read the CIT opinion as suggesting it was dispositive.
Well, we read the CIT's opinion, and we agree that under normal circumstances, the conversion schedules are relevant. But in this case, and in the Balchamon case, that was one of the cases that the government cited, when the language is so different between the TUSIS and the HTS provision, in that case, the court held that the conversion schedule wasn't even persuasive because the language was different. And what the court did here was it looked at the conversion schedule. In our reading of it was he did rely on the conversion schedule. He stated in the court stated in his opinion that the conversion schedule equated the two provisions. That's not the purpose of the conversion schedule. It's not to equate them. It's to give the importing community some guidance in determining if they have a TUSIS provision with a possible HTS provision and vice versa. It's not supposed to equate them. And I think that's where the trial court sort of went wrong in its opinion.
But you have, the trial court suggested that there might be a difference in the legislative histories in Semper and here, but your response to Judge Gellman's question was that you had no support in the legislative history for your position.
Right, there,
is that right?
Well, there is no express support that states, you know, 3921 is not supposed to dovetail the scope of 35.81.
Or to explain the change
that is significant. But consistent with traditional rules of statutory interpretation, as well as the other rules of interpretation, whereas the general rule is you give every word to the extent possible in a statute effect and meaning. And when if 355.81 is the is used to interpret 3921.90.11, all the words in that operative language are read out, and it's rewriting the statute instead of interpreting it as it's written.
But as I recall, when the tariff schedules were harmonized, there was elaborate explanation of changes, so that those who use, which is a vast number of people, who can't go back and read the legislative history for every importation, to point out changes that were intended to be made. And here, there is no such record, I gather.
Now, while we couldn't find any record, and we did some research at the Barris Library, but we couldn't find...
But you're telling us to make some assumptions or presumptions based on silence, when the tradition is the opposite of silence.
Well, presumptions based on well-established principles of statutory interpretation. Going with 35.5.81 goes against those principles. It reads the language right out of 3921.90.11.
I think what this all boils down to are two propositions. One is your position depends, I think, on a plain reading of the word predominate as the CIT court, as the Semper court went through. And that makes sense to me. But that would mean an unambiguous term. But the government's own position, having taken two positions on that same term, kind of indicates that there at least was some ambiguity as far as the government is concerned, whoever that is, and that leaves us to fall back on a little bit of legislative history we have, and the one piece we do have is the president's pronouncement of HTSUS, which he says to avoid, to the extent practicable, consonant with sound nomenclature principle changes in rates on individual products, and that's exactly what happened here. The same product becomes taxed at a higher rate simply because of the change from TSUS to HTSUS, which seems to be contrary to the executive's interpretation of that process.
So it was a change from the tax-based TSUS to the HTSUS. It was accompanied by a change in language. And if there was really an intent to have those two provisions cover the same merchandise, that language would have been carried over, and it wasn't. And finally, I'd like to point out that that operative language appears elsewhere in the harmonized tariff schedule. So if we actually adopt what the trial court did here, every time we see that language, we're going to have to go back to the conversion table, look at where mated TUSIS provision is, go back to that legislative history.
Not necessarily, counsel, because the word doesn't exist in a vacuum. The word predominate exists in the context of its usage. And for example, from the Semperit case to this case, the other one specifically talks about the Semperit case and where the word predominate appears, specifically talks about a second material. Whereas this particular provision uses the word predominate, but doesn't mention the presence necessarily of a second material. So while I'm sympathetic to the government not wanting to have to go back and revisit every time the word predominate appears in the classification system, statutory construction isn't that simple. It's not a word in isolation, but rather a word in the context in which it's used. And so while predominate, it's possible, could mean one thing in one section, based on how it's used, it might actually very well mean another thing somewhere else. It might actually require a second material elsewhere because the way in which it's used indicates that that was clearly the intent.
I agree, but actually I guess I wasn't clear. The operative language at issue here appears in other provisions. If you actually look at 3921...
Are you talking about the word predominate, or am I misunderstanding
the word? The operative language, products with textile components which, in which man-made fibers predominate by weight over any other single fiber. That actual language appears over and over again in the HTS provision, especially like in textile provisions, and in the same heading, 3921. So just interpreting the rest of the headings in 3921, the subheadings, you'd have to go through that long process to the conversion, and then to the thesis, and then to the history, and then make a decision instead of just saying, okay, this is what this operative language means. It's the same language that was used in Sanskrit. Use it here and use it throughout the harmonized whenever we see that operative language.
Let's hear from the other side. Mr. Gibbons.
Given, does it make sense that 51% to 99% of material is man-made, but an object with 100% of man-made material would be taxed at a different rate?
Doesn't make any sense to me. No.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with that, too.
I have trouble with that. And I have trouble with that in the context of the legislative history, where it says, all man-made fibers in 355.81. And here it's 355.81, and the cheap value was there for another reason in this interim period.
You look at the split between man-made and natural fiber, right? That's the split.
I'm sorry.
You look at the categorization as it focuses on man-made fiber.
That's right. And to take 99% man-made fiber and put it here, and take 100% and put it to another actually, it's a full other provision, doesn't make any sense. And I don't know what I can say to...
predominates by weight. You know what? It certainly, in the abstract, suggests the presence of a second. If I were just looking at that word in the newspaper and there was nothing around it, I would be concerned that it actually...
The best argument in the world I've seen is the one the government put forth in Sanskrit for that. And of course, negated that, of course. But I think the real problem we have here is we interpret the tariff according to the way you're supposed to interpret the tariff, or do you interpret the tariff in a way that's convenient? We interpret the tariff to give effect to the congressional mandate and to the legislative and executive
and the central
directive.
Policy.
Yeah. And the back to 65. They included rayon in this same 355.81 provision, and rayon was 100%. And the executive order, Reagan 81, said, to the extent you can, have the same duty rate. When you take out this 1%, and you get up 1% going to another provision, it seems ludicrous to us.
Well, but aren't we stuck with the language? I mean, predominate, if you had a one-party political system, you wouldn't say it predominates over anything because you've only got one party. If you had a small oppositional political party, then you wouldn't say it predominates, no matter how small that was. This is Putin for us here. You would still say they predominate, but if there's nothing to predominate over, I mean, that's the word they use. They went from cheap value, as counsel pointed out, from a value-based system to a weight system, and they used the term not just predominate, they said over any other. What does other mean?
As the government argued in Sanskrit, other can mean nothing. Other can mean nothing.
But they lost.
And they lost. They lost. But it was still a weighty argument, and the Sanskrit case decided predominate in the sense that you used predominate, which is a common meaning, dealt with a different chapter, different heading, different merchandise, different legislative history. And each chapter and each heading in the tariff schedule deals with its own legislative history, and it comes with a burden of interpretation according to its legislative history. If it's unambiguous on its face, That's if you don't go any further. If it's ambiguous on its face, then you've got to go to the legislative history of that provision. The trial judge, I think, did that very well. He went to legislative history and he saw back in 1965, you see it, 3581 still said of, which meant wholly of or in chief value of, and then this chief value change was for the purpose of, at the time there was a lot of difficulty in the trade, certain things that were plastic were, they were being classified in the plastic provisions versus the textile provisions, and they said, no, this is irrelevant. You still got out, and down here you've got predominate. They said keep things neutral when we can. And so we don't do this crazy, and I think it's crazy, interpretation of predominate with respect to this check.
Well, so if we were to agree with you in this case, we would be implicitly, if not explicitly, overruling Semprit, or at least nullifying Semprit as a lower court.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is really troublesome. I mean, I assume that you, as an experienced practitioner in this field, as importers and people who deal with the tariff schedule for millions of such, who need to know what their costs are going to be, but when there's a different classification and a different rate, in fact, does counsel go back and search out the legislative history when reading and advising clients on...
Regrettably, Your Honor, that's what they have to do. You know, that's just what they have to do. There's no better way of doing it than to look at the legislative history of that provision, and that's the legislative history. So if you don't take 99% and whip 1% down, oh my goodness. You don't put 99% and another and 1% of it, it just wholly take it out.
I'm a little confused. I mean, we don't look to the legislative history every time, only when there is some ambiguity.
That's correct.
The government suggested, though, that these words sort of dominate a large portion of the tariff statute. And so does that mean that every time these words appear, someone's going to have to go to the legislative history to ascertain? Or once we pronounce what the words mean, having looked at the legislative history, does that apply to all further usages of the... I'm curious. I don't know what you envision in terms of our...
Well, we know that in the separate case, I'm past my time, Your Honor, because...
You are?
You're fine.
As soon as you have your time. 8 minutes and 17 seconds left.
I'm all right.
It feels like a million years, but it really hasn't been that long.
The separate case, let me see if I remember your question. Please rephrase it.
Okay. The question was, what do you envision our holding will be in terms of how it will impact, how often will people be going back to the legislative history? Is it every time these words appear? Because my thought was, well, wait a minute, we only look to the legislative history if there's ambiguity, and maybe there's not a lot of other ambiguity in this thing, so that the words themselves will dominate behavior, and every person won't have to go to the legislative history for every single determination. But the government suggested that these identical words appear in lots of places. And my question to you was, if they appear in lots of places, in your vision of our holding, what you would like to see happen here, is it the case that you would like us to say these words mean we don't have to have a second material and that's true everywhere they appear, or are we only dealing with this tiny little section because the legislative history for this section suggests this should be the outcome?
I see your point, Your Honor.
I'm wondering how broad you want our holding to be.
Well, and I can see very easily your point that it would be administratively much easier if you had one meaning for predominate. But you don't have one meaning for predominate. And they not only held it in that case that it was ambiguous, they took position that held that it was ambiguous, but they were ruling for 5 years held that it was ambiguous. And before Semprit ever came along, they had 5 years worth of customs ruling that held that it was
But if these 7 or 8 words appear together in multiple places, why aren't they to be construed the same way every time they appear?
Because you don't leave the tariff that the tariff is not interpreted that way. The tariff is interpreted by each chapter, by each heading, and you can only take the heading before the court and determine what the legislative history is. That provides the certainty. Certainly we require a lawyer to advise the importer what the classification is, but you, I think you're bound to the chapter, to the heading that covers that particular language. I'm sorry, no. I believe that's the law. I'm not.
But Sophie, you're suggesting that a word used in one section of the same statute can have a different meaning than you.
Exactly.
A word as common as the word predominant.
As the word predominant.
Well, you have to take that. Thank you.
Any more questions? Do you have any more questions, Mr. Gibbons? Anything else you need to tell us?
No, I have no further.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gibbons.
Thank you. I'll give my glass and drink.
Mr. Howell, we've exhausted your time, but is there anything else you need to tell us? You can have a minute in rebuttal if there's anything raised by Mr. Gibbons that you want to respond to.
The only point we want to make in closing is that from my recollection, I do believe that there is case law that says when words appear to different parts of the statute, they're ordinarily meant to have the same meaning. I don't have that. I'm trying to find it in my file, but...
No, it's a tool of statutory interpretation. You're not wrong.
Okay.
No, you're not wrong.
Okay, I just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Do you have any exceptions to that general principle?
No, sorry.
Well, what do you think about this 51%, 99%, 100% idea? Because it just, I have to say, the government's position from a policy standpoint, and I realize I'm not here to determine policy, but it just seems like nonsensical. If 99% of this particular material is man-made and therefore falls in this category, the category was meant to encapsulate material where it's pretty much all man-made. Why say, well, if it's 100%, then it doesn't put in that category. It goes somewhere else and get taxed at a different rate. If anything, I would think since there's a lower tax rate for the man-made, isn't there a lower tax rate for the man-made material, or is it the other way around?
I think it's lower for the man-made material.
Yeah, so if it's lower for man-made, so we like the idea of the man-made better, then why don't we like the idea of the man-made better when it's 100% man-made? From a policy standpoint, do you follow me?
I understand it doesn't make too much sense from a policy perspective, but the language of the statute is...
But doesn't presume Congress made rational decisions when it enacted this? And from a policy standpoint, I can see no logical reason at all why Congress would say if it's 100%, it goes into a higher tax rate. If it's 99%, it stays here. And when I read statutes, I generally presume the legislature to have acted rationally. And I generally look at it with an idea that I can appreciate or have some sense of why there might be some logical reason they would draw a distinction that you want me to find exists in the statute. I mean, I don't disagree that the words can be interpreted the way that the government argues. I don't disagree with that. I think that there is clearly ambiguity here by all we've gone over today. But the problem that I have is I can't imagine for the life of me why Congress would have intended to have 100% man-made materials get taxed at a higher rate.
I understand.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gibbons. The case is taken under submission.